Thanks all very much for coming along, and it's my pleasure to brief you today on the Cabinet decisions around the review of the Immigration Act. As you'll see from our first slide, the Immigration Change Program has three core components, of which the Immigration Act review that we're discussing today is the first. The other two will come next year, so there's more after this. This Act review tries to deliver on response to three key trends that we know we need to deliver on. The first is facilitating access to the skills that New Zealand needs for economic transformation. We are very short of labour, and we're particularly short of skilled labours in some high demand areas of the economy. You probably know ICT, medical services, education, some of the basic trades. We are crying out for good people. The problem is, so is the rest of the world. And what we understand is that we're going to have to work harder with smarter systems to get the best people. We also know that we live in a world which is getting increasingly complex and more risky post 9/11, and we have to have enhanced security at the border. So those are two dimensions that we have to improve our game on at the same time, and this Act review provides the foundations for doing that. The implementation follows in the policy framework and in the delivery machinery, which you will see more of next year. The third objective, we will be making announcements early in the new year, is on settlement. Obviously, when people do come here, the migration process doesn't stop until they are well settled, happy and productive in New Zealand, and we're going to have more to say about delivering on that objective as well. On the next slide, the timeline for the Immigration Act review process. Policy work started last year, and it led up to the announcement of the discussion document in April. It's been out for public consultation since then, and today we're announcing Cabinet's decisions in light of that consultation. I want to say right up front that I'm really pleased with how that process has gone. We've had around 4,000 public submissions, which is quite a lot. We've had over 650 people come to focus group meetings on this issue. And we've had an extremely comprehensive process of interagency consultation throughout the government and with statutory bodies. I've personally been through this probably about four times per chapter, and officials have worked very, very hard to deliver a comprehensive and, I think, pretty good reform. What we're going to obviously wait to see is public submissions to the Select Committee process, which will go on through next year once the bill is introduced about March or April. Next slide. I talked earlier about delivering simultaneously on two core objectives, facilitating the skills we need for our economic transformation and also ensuring the enhanced security of our border. This Act review delivers on both of those. In facilitating skills, as you'll see from the chapters that follow, we're going to have a much simplified visa system that will be easier for migrants and their families to work. We're going to have more flexible decision-making tools that will speed up the process, supported by organisational changes at the department, and including the ability to delegate some discretions to senior officials. We're going to have a world-class single protection system to ensure that our systems for refugee claims, protection against torture, are all integrated in one simple, easy-to-understand and comprehensive process. We're going to have a single appeals tribunal rather than the four that we currently have that will be more efficient and more streamlined. It will give more consistent decisions. We're going to be able to use biometric information so that we can ensure that we have accuracy of our case files and that we do the right thing by each individual applicant. On the security side, there will be a streamlined deportation procedure that will allow a single claim and a single appeal on the facts, law and humanitarian grounds. We've beefed up some of the humanitarian aspects of that since the discussion document, but we've retained the single appeal process. There will be an ability to use, under certain rather tighter safeguards than in the discussion document, classified information in respect of individuals who are a high security risk. There will be incentives and the ability for third parties such as employers to have access to and some obligations around information that verifies the employee's status of their people. There will also be enhanced safeguards to ensure that that information is not abused. And I should say that we've worked closely with the Ministry of Justice on this, and that there is not a single clause of this where there is any outstanding Bill of Rights issue. So we're very pleased that we've worked through to agreement on all of those matters. there will be an improved detention system that will fill in some gaps in the existing powers of immigration officers so that we can deliver the service that the public expects about removing illegal people and ensuring that we can maintain the security of the border. Talk about that in a minute. Obviously, the biometric information has useful security implications as well as facilitation improvements. Before I go chapter by chapter, I just want to summarise up a few of the differences since the April discussion document. We do have further movement towards facilitation. We have drafted a purpose statement that embeds that in the Act. We have simplified the visa system. We are providing for more responsiveness and efficiency by enabling the Minister to delegate positive decision-makings. We're enabling electronic decision-making and, as I said, the ability to use biometric information. On human rights protections, we've beefed up the protection safeguards around the use of classified information. We've strengthened the appeals procedure. We are going to include, as well as the Refugee Convention, also the Convention Against Torture and the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights embedded in the protection system, and that's a step forward on where we've been up to now. There will be a robust independent appeals system which we've strengthened, and we will have, that placed in the Ministry of Justice so that it is hands-off from immigration officers making the frontline decisions. We, as I said, be enhancing border security and provisions for third parties. We've talked about that. But the message that I want to leave you with today is that we have listened very carefully to the feedback from submissioners. We have made a number of changes, which you'll see set out quite clearly in your orange document. What we've done to make it very transparent is give you four columns. The status quo is what the existing law says, the discussion paper, what we heard from submissioners, and on this side what the final decision is. So it's all absolutely transparent. You can see where we've been and you can see where we've changed the policy in response to the submission process. And there's an opportunity for further submissions to the Select Committee in due course next year. If people are interested, I'm happy to go through on a chapter-by-chapter basis in a little more detail, or I'm happy to take questions at a general level now if you'd prefer. Chapter-by-chapter summary? Okay, let's do that. Next slide, core provisions. Key here is that we're going to put a purpose statement in the Act. It doesn't currently have one, and it's going to embed those three objectives that we talked about on the top slide. Facilitating the access to more skills and more human resources for New Zealand, very important, strengthening the border and improving settlement. The essence of what we want is for this Act to provide a foundation that changes the role the Immigration Service plays from being a reactive processing operation for whoever turns up and lodges an application to being a proactive human resources agency for the country. We're going to have to compete harder with other countries to get the skills we want. We're going to have to be sharper about identifying the particular migrants that can best assist New Zealand, and we're going to have to be more competitive about going out and finding and recruiting the people we need. And this Act provides the foundation, which we will carry through in the policy framework and in the operational changes of the department. We're going to embed the rights of New Zealand citizens. We will start with the proposition that non-citizens must hold a relevant visa, and of course there will be robust exclusion provisions. Chapter 2 on visas. There will be a visa system. At the moment there's visas and permits. Now a lot of people, including me when I started this job, didn't understand the difference. We've collapsed it all into one simple system. It's only visas now, which will make it easier for everybody, including migrants and their families. There's a new interim visa for temporary entrants who are awaiting further visa decisions. That clarifies their status when they're waiting. There's been very strong public support for that stuff. Decision making. At the moment we have an issue which is that too many appeals end up on the Associate Minister's desk. And we don't think it's sufficient or fair to applicants that we get such a large number, and it doesn't frankly show that the system is working ideally. The Act review contains the power for the Minister to delegate some of that decision-making where discretion is required to certain senior officials. The Minister will still retain an overall discretion to make that decision. That hasn't changed. And we are also retaining the current Section 35A power, which means that if a migrant has got illegal, maybe they've overstayed by accident or maybe even deliberately, there will still be the power to grant a 35A to legalise their status so that the substantive hearing can be heard. We will also be enabling electronic decision making. A majority, for example, of our student visas are now done electronically. It's quicker, it's faster, it's fairer, and the risk is no higher provided we segment it well. So there will be more of that in the future. Protection. As I indicated, there will now be a single determination process for refugee torture and cruel treatment obligations. This is certainly a step forward for the human rights community. It means that equal treatment is given to these two new conventions, torture and cruel treatment, in our law alongside the Refugee Convention. Serious offenders and threats identified in the protection determination process must be dealt with, but the Minister must also uphold those obligations. Now, one of the issues here that was quite controversial is that under the Convention Against Torture, it's not possible to send a person back to a country where it is known that the person might face torture. And careful consideration has been given to whether we would embed the Convention in our domestic law. We've decided that we will do that, and that we will place upon the Minister the obligation of making the final decision on individual cases that are caught in that way. We've decided at this time not to sign the Stateless Persons Convention. That is not because we don't think in principle that this is something New Zealand might one day do, but because at this time we do not have sufficient information to quantify the costs and benefits of doing so properly. There are more stateless persons in the world than there currently are refugees, and there is a potential for there to be a very large expansion in the number of claims if we did this without full info. So we are deferring that decision while we gather more information on that matter. Deportation. At the moment, there is both a deportation and a removal system. Deportation, where you commit a criminal offence or another serious act in New Zealand. Removal, if there's been fraud or some other problem with the way you got your visa or permit. We're going to collapse that into a single streamlined system, but it will also be a graduated and tiered system that ensures that the penalty matches the crime. So if you're deported, for example, on a minor matter, you may only be banned from the country for 2 years. If you are on a more serious matter, you could have a 5-year ban, or in the most serious cases, a lifetime ban. The existing lawful status remains during appeals, and a minister or a senior officer may cancel or suspend liability. So there is a presumption that someone becomes liable for deportation if they commit an offence or otherwise qualify, but their rights to appeal are protected, and the discretion of the minister is protected to stay that deportation. Review and appeal, another very important chapter here, and I think we have a world-class system coming out of this review. A single independent appeals tribunal with a single right of appeal to tribunal. Now, I gave the example when we launched the paper in April about some people who make multiple claims and multiple appeals in respect of refugee matters, sometimes on the way to the airport when all other avenues have failed. And it is important that the New Zealand public is not subjected to undue process expense or time, and it's also fairer and more transparent to the refugee claimant that the whole process is up front, that it's clear that their rights and humanitarian appeal rights are fully protected, but it's dealt with in a systematic way, and that's what this will deliver. There is a judicial review and appeal on points of law that needs to be filed with the leave of the court within 28 days. New slide, classified information. This was again quite a discussed item in the consultation process, and the short answer here is that for the very few cases each year, probably less than you can count on one hand, where there is an issue with someone's security risk, we will allow the use of classified information, and there will be enhanced safeguards relative to the April discussion document. You'll see some of the details in your materials. But rather than relying upon the Inspector General of Security Intelligence to provide the sole appeal function, we're now going to have a panel of three judges with special advocates available to the claimant or the applicant who is under appeal, and that will fully protect their human rights during the process. But in the post 9/11 world, I'm afraid it is a sad fact of life that we do need the ability to use some special information under certain limited circumstances. Third parties. We thought very carefully about this one as well. We had a number of submissions on this. Currently, employers do have an obligation to ensure that the migration status of their employees is valid. Currently, they can use an IRD number as evidence of that. The problem is that you don't need to have a valid visa or permit to get an IRD number, and the system is therefore sometimes abused. The decision here is that we will reaffirm the obligation, that we will provide with privacy safeguards the ability of employers to access information on the migration status of prospective employees. Only registered employers can do so, and they take on an obligation to protect the privacy and confidentiality of that information, and they can get no more than whether a person is legal or not. So you might say that's a halfway house from the rather broader powers that were proposed in the April document. There will be instant fines for carriers, airlines, if they do not have systems or do not provide the information that's required to facilitate customs or immigration clearance. And there will be information disclosure for assessing the eligibility of publicly funded services. So if somebody wants to apply for a benefit once they get here, we need to be able to check out their immigration status to check their ability to legally obtain that. Next slide, compliance and enforcement. It's been quite clear through this process that there are currently some gaps in the compliance and enforcement powers of immigration officers. This is not an easy job. It's not a job, frankly, that people enjoy doing. But we do have a number of people in New Zealand who are here illegally. We try to deal with them properly and with due sensitivity to their circumstances, but the reality is that sometimes we do need to remove people. Occasionally there are high-risk individuals who can be identified, and although immigration officers currently work closely with the police, sometimes, unavoidably, there are delays before police can arrive at a scene. And that means we currently don't have the power to hold somebody in detention until they get there. We're fixing that. Another issue is that we don't have the power to hold someone in an airport on their way into the country long enough for their appropriate outbound flight. For some countries, there's only a flight a couple of times a week. And so we've got a 96-hour detention period possible under certain circumstances in this Act. Currently, there is a... I'll move on to the next slide, which I've already jumped to, actually. Courts can issue warrants for detentions currently up to 7 days. We're changing that to up to 28 days. This is really just to streamline a procedure that's happening de facto anyway. There is no point in putting a case back to a judge every week when the facts of the case haven't changed from the week before. Doing it monthly still provides a very adequate human rights safeguard, but streamlines the process. We are codifying the detention provisions, and frankly we are strengthening the burden on the department to establish the basis of detention. Detention is generally going to be limited to up to 6 months. There will be some circumstances, particularly where there's clear non-cooperation by someone who needs to leave New Zealand, where that can be extended, but that's going to be codified through a process where someone may be actually in contempt if they do not comply with the law. Now, that is a significant step forward in terms of the codification of the rights of the detainee, and I think makes more transparent a process which has been operating up to now. So we're, I think, pleased with that outcome. Designated officers may detain up to 4 hours. That's the element I referred to earlier where police may not be there in time. And terms of reference are sought on secure immigration detention facilities. Let me just say that in the long run, it's my hope that we might find we can afford a proper immigration detention facility. If someone arrives at the airport and they need to be turned around to leave New Zealand in 24 or 48 hours, currently we don't have any alternative but to put them in a police detention facility. Now that's less than desirable in some cases because the person hasn't done anything wrong in all cases, and certainly not in New Zealand. So we would like to see our way clear over time to there being an appropriate secure detention facility for immigration purposes. This gives us the legal power, then we've then got to go through the budget process and the operational process of delivering that. We have to get that in the Act now. Next slide, biometric information. Look, all around the developed world, countries are moving to biometrics for two reasons. One, in the enhanced security environment, you need to be able to be very sure who a person is, and it's almost impossible to rort a fingerprint or an iris scan, which are two popular biometric techniques now. It will come to the stage where if New Zealand doesn't have the powers to match this, we may even find the travel rights of New Zealanders could be curtailed in other countries. And it's important that we too, secondly, have the legal powers to ensure the integrity of our border. And that means that we are going to be moving over time to a biometric base for all migration applicants. And that will be the anchor, if you like, on a new, much improved IT central nervous system for the immigration service that will be rolled out progressively over the next few years, subject to the budget process. That's not in the Act, it's in the operational change that you'll see more of next year. But this provides the legal powers for the biometrics. Summarising the next steps, Cabinet signed off on all of this, so this will now go into bill drafting. It'll be introduced to the House, target is April 07, this says legislation passed by April 08, and that of course means that there's a select committee process that will go on between the two Aprils. My hope is that it may actually come out of the select committee process a little earlier than that, if we can. It would be nice to get it through in calendar 07. My officials will tell me I'm always in a hurry. But people will have the full rights of submission to the select committee process if there are any residual concerns. Now, no system's perfect. The current one certainly isn't. I can't promise none of you will find a comrade of place somewhere in the thousands of pages of stuff here. But I can tell you it's been an extremely thorough process, and we are all pretty happy with the outcome, and we welcome your questions.
Regarding the biometrics issue, natural citizens of New Zealand don't have to provide iris scans or thumbprints unless they go through the courts process. Aren't we having one rule for one group and one rule for another with this?
Nothing new in that. New Zealand citizens don't need a visa to come to their own country. Same legal argument.
But if they're coming here permanently...
If they're coming here and they want to travel to New Zealand, then they currently need to establish their identity and they currently need to go through a visa or permit process. Nothing legally is changing other than the technological means of assuring that identity, which in future all around the developed world is going to be biometric, and we have to be part of that process.
It's going to be held in permanent record though, isn't it?
That subject to strong privacy and confidentiality provisions, it'll be held.
So are you saying that every person who applies for a visa to come to New Zealand is going to have to provide fingerprints, iris scans, well, obviously photographs, which we provide now anyway.
What I need to make clear is that what we're doing in the Act review is providing the legal power to require that in future. Yes. This is not the policy decision that we are going to require it at any particular time. That will come later. But I think it's a fair bet that over time the system will need to move from biometric base. Yes.
So that would mean that if I'm coming on a 6-month... holiday visa, I would have to provide this information?
Cabinet hasn't made decisions about which visa types this would apply to at what time, and I don't want to prejudge that Cabinet process, but what I would repeat is that all around the developed world, biometric information is seen as essential to assure the identity of the applicant, and I should imagine that over time will be the same in New Zealand.
Has it been discussed whether that information will be kept separate for immigration purposes or be linked to the police as well?
That's not a matter that I have at the top of my mind at the moment.
That would be a form of discussion that we'd have later.
Yep, that would be subject to the Cabinet process.
But are we talking about the same sort of fingerprinting regime, for example, at the United States, where everyone who comes through a U.S. airport is fingerprinted?
No decisions have been made at this stage on the type of biometric regime that we would have. Cabinet will need to consider those matters at a later date. What the bill provides is, or will provide, is the basic legal power to move forward on a biometric information regime. So it's a several step process, this is only step one.
And it wouldn't necessarily be restricted to visas, people with visas, it could be all non-citizens.
That's still got to go through the Cabinet process. Yeah.
There was some talk in the April paper of the power to take DNA samples. I'm not sure I saw that on the biometric slide. Has that been dropped or is that still...
Yeah, that's been dropped.
Why?
These things all require a balance between the ability to assure identity and protection of confidentiality and privacy and personal information. I think the judgment was made that that's probably more information than we currently need to assure identity.
I mean, DNA obviously became an issue. I think that Steve Peters last year, the year before, was claiming that people had come in as relatives under family category visas who weren't actually related to the principal applicant, and that DNA testing would be one way of establishing that.
Yes, that's a separate provision, and my understanding is that there can still be a requirement to provide DNA to establish it, to request, sorry, not require, DNA to establish a family link for a family category or sometimes for a refugee family category application. Yep. Now, a person has the right to withhold that, but it could help their case to be able to provide it.
That was in the original paper, I think it was a voluntary...
Yeah. So there's no power to require them. There's no need for new legislation on that point.
What were the other key things that have been dropped as a result of... Just because we've only had a chance to look at it.
Yeah, no, it's a lot to absorb.
Can you summarise what...
Well, I think what you overall can say is that there are some additional privacy and human rights protections here alongside the facilitative measures that we earlier foreshadowed. Things like the new three-judge panel to oversee any appeals or claims on the use of classified information. Things like strengthened privacy protections around third-party information, tighter confidentiality obligations on employers. We've dropped the health criteria proposed from the purpose statement. We have made potentially prejudicial information available to all applicants, not just onshore applicants, which is a significant extension of that protection. We have limited the proposed increased powers of immigration officers by adding some robust safeguards requiring government to sign off on evidence of appropriate training and delegation, and that would be by order and council. Two-stage process. Governor-General has to certify that the system is robust before it can start, and then ministers have to certify on individual uses of immigration officer delegation and powers. And finally, some additional safeguards have been brought in around detention issues. So the detail is all in there, but you could probably describe this fairly as a rebalancing, taking account of the public submissions around human rights and privacy issues, and also as a result of close cooperation between the Department and the Ministry of Justice. As I said earlier, we've now got to the point that there are no remaining issues from the point of view of the Ministry of Justice from a Bill of Rights perspective, and I'm very pleased about that, and it's something that I've been concerned to see.
Have you got guaranteed legislative support from other parties to get this
done? Yes, we have strong support from our support parties for this bill.
Given there's been some problems with immigrants coming here with health issues, TB, AIDS, why have you dropped that?
We're still going to have the need to have health screening. It's just that that's contained adequately in the policy, and we don't need to put it in the purpose statement of the law. There was really no legal need to change where that's located. You're quite right, it is an issue, and you'll see that since last November, December 05, we've vastly upgraded the health screening requirements, and that's probably a process that'll be ongoing.
But who have you got support from this side? New Zealand First, obviously.
United Future, and New Zealand First, and of course Progressives, and I wouldn't be surprised if the support ends up being even broader than that.
But when was United Future briefed, though? Because they hadn't been briefed on this.
I've spoken to their spokesman this morning, and they've obviously had access to the range of documents, and they've been looking at the discussion document like other people.
Regarding use of classified information, has that been developed out of what happened to the Ahmed Zoe case?
An important thing to note here is that while nothing here will affect the Zoe case in any way, because that must be held on the basis of the law as it existed at the time he made his claim, Cabinet has made the decision to bring forward the review of Part 4A of the Act, potentially to before the Zoe case has been finally resolved. Won't affect the consideration on Zawi in any way, but given that the legal process there seems to be quite an extended one, we didn't want to hold up the potential to review Part 4A, so that could come forward to before the Zawi case is resolved.
So what's
Part 4A? Part 4A is the part of the Act that provides for the issuing of the security risk certificate under which Mr. Zawi's been held.
So that could be done now before that case is resolved?
Correct.
What stage is that process at?
The process hasn't started, the review process hasn't started, and I'm not the guy to talk to about where the Zawi process is at because it hasn't ended up on my desk yet. That's probably something I'm going to enjoy getting my teeth into in future years.
But have you got a time frame for starting the review of the security risk?
Not a specific time frame yet, but we are saying, based on Cabinet decision, it could be before the Zawi case has been finalised, and that's a change. Earlier we had indicated that we thought we would wait until the Zawi case had been completed.
So is that just legal advice saying that you didn't need to wait for the
Zawi? A, we didn't need to wait, and B, frankly, the timelines on the resolution of the Zawi case have extended out. It's not through any choice of the government, but just the nature of the legal process, which probably exhibits why the law might need to be reviewed in the first place. It's something that obviously I think we all have a shared interest in seeing resolved as quickly as possible, subject to due process of law. But I won't be making any comment whatsoever on the substance of the Zawi case, as I'll ultimately be a decision maker on it.
Do you make any announcements on the outcome of the review while the Zawi case was still underway?
We may well, but we'll be very clear that nothing in that review would affect the Zawi case itself in any way, because it must be determined on the basis of the law as it existed at the time.
How much is all this going to cost? I mean, are you going to need to spend considerable amounts of money setting up biometric systems, etc.?
Yes, we will. Look, what we're talking about is moving to a world-class immigration system from currently a very good one, and there will be additional cost in that, not least during transition. Some of the changes will actually be lower cost, for example, increased use of electronic channels. Just like banks, it's cheaper to process an FPOS transaction than a cheque. It's also quicker and easier to process an online application, and we can still segment by risk. So we're going to be going through a process subject to budget approval over the next couple of years and subject to much more due diligence that will seek to give our immigration service enhanced capabilities, better IT, further enhancements in training, further enhancements in systems and decision-making tools that will mean we get quicker, more consistent and better decisions. Not that the system's broken, but the game is continually raising around the world and we have to make sure we're ahead of the pack.
So how do you put a dollar figure on?
Not at this stage. No, we've got more due diligence to do.
How would you judge this accessible? I mean, the result of fewer people coming to New Zealand, different sorts of people coming to New Zealand?
Well, I would judge the success of this on the objectives that we set out in the top couple of slides. If we're able to have a migration system that consistently provides high-quality, skilled migrants that assist our economic transformation, that mean that we can compete well with other countries to get the folks we need, that we are meeting our international obligations, we're also meeting obligations to families, all of those are good things, and of course the New Zealand public demands, quite rightly, that the security of our border is protected, and we need to be able to ensure that going forward in an increasingly complex environment. In both dimensions, the facilitation dimension and the security dimension, the game worldwide is changing. We need new powers and new tools to not only keep up but future-proof, and that's what we're about today.
It's quite clear that you've made moves to make it easier to boot out undesirables, if you like. But your other objective, which is attracting the right people for our economy, what are the main points in this effort that you achieve there?
Things like a simplified visa system, clearer, faster legal rights and obligations, will let people know where they stand. Things like providing for electronic decision making.
They are,
and you're quite right, Guyan, because coming right back to the first slide, the Act review is only the first of three parts of the change program. It's the skeleton upon which the policy hangs, from which the delivery is generated. Now, the policy reviews, much of which we'll be announcing in the new year, will give you, for example, potentially new policies around investor and business migration, further enhancements to skilled migration, refinements on refugee policy, all of those things. And so this is the framework. there's much, much more that we're going to be rolling out to you that will put the flesh on those bones and deliver on those objectives. But you can't start until you've got the legal powers. And what we've got here is a 20-year-old piece of legislation that was written for quite a different world than we now live in. And so after more than a year's work, I think we're now in the position where we've got a future-proof, world-class legislative basis to work off. We look forward to it being considered and passed through the House.
So just going back to the security certificates.
Sorry, one and then two. Yep.
So, when I misheard you earlier, I thought you said that there was provision, or there was a move towards having a three-judge panel to review those.
No, there's two separate provisions here. There's use of classified information other than the security risk certificate. The security risk certificate is done under Part 4A of the Act. What I've announced today is that the review of that will probably precede, not succeed, the conclusion of the Zowie case. There's also additional powers being introduced in this review to allow the use of classified security information under certain very limited circumstances with some very strict safeguards. And relative to the April discussion document, what's new here is that those safeguards have been strengthened so that in respect of that use of security info, there will be a three-judge panel plus special advocates acting on behalf of the person about whom the information applies. Mm-hmm. Now, whether the 4A review brings some of the existing 4A provisions more into line with that is something that we'll just have to see when the review is done.
So, I was just going to say, that makes sense with you, if you've got a three-judge panel,
it may do. That's just a job of work that we've still got to do. And what we're signalling is that we think because we've got this proceeding, it makes sense to consider exactly that matter sooner rather than later.
So what happens, like...
And I'm conscious that I missed Ruth, who got picked up the place for a previous question. You're right, Ruth?
People are partway through the appeals process.
Yep.
What happens to them?
No change. Their appeals will be decided on the basis of the law as it stood when they commence. Am I right on that?
Yeah. Yep.
So what happens, let's say you pass this legislation through mid-next year or whatever.
Yep.
What happens to the guy...
You're an optimist. It might take slightly longer than mid-next year. But yeah. Yep.
What happens to the guy who comes over on a plane from somewhere,
yep,
flushes his documents down the toilet on the plane,
yep,
let's say,
yep,
logs up at the airport, and we decide we don't want him here?
That's a good example. Just like now, that person will enjoy the full protection of the law, in fact, expanded protections of the law against torture and against cruel treatment. Just like they do now, they can make a refugee claim. And they have the full protection of a more streamlined and integrated appeal process at their disposal. What they won't have is the ability to make ad infinitum multiple appeal claims if they lose the first hearing and then the claim. What we're doing is telescoping all of that work into a single claim and then a single appeal, both on the facts and on humanitarian issues. And if they're not happy with that, it can then go on appeal to the court within 28 days. But what you can't do under this law is 2 years, 10 years later, come up with a fresh appeal.
How long then would you expect someone who applies for refugee status to be in New Zealand before decisions?
Typically much shorter than they currently are. Sometimes at the moment it takes decades. And the problem with that is, A, it can cost the taxpayer a fortune, and secondly, even if people find that there isn't good grounds to uphold a refugee claim, after 10 years of them and their family living in New Zealand, they can make a case that they're well settled.
But you must have an estimated time. I mean, would it be 6 months, a year, 18 months?
Officials want to venture a guess?
No, I don't think.
I think it's probably not appropriate for us to put a number on it.
Depending on the country they come from.
And look, this is part of respect for the individual case too. You don't want to prejudge on a case-by-case basis. But the expectation is, on average, it will be significantly streamlined from the current status quo.
Just continue on with Guy's example, though. I mean, what say you, this guy gets here and his name immediately rings alarm bells. You're fairly sure he's dodgy, potentially a security risk.
Yeah.
If he just simply says, I claim refugee status, you can't turn around and put him on a plane back, can you?
That's an interesting question, because I think it goes to the intersection of several parts of law. The person still has the right to make a refugee claim. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, lawyers, but if there is a valid reason for believing the person is a security risk, special additional provisions could cut in. Graham, do you want to comment?
Well, the normal process would be that person would be detained and their refugee claim ceased while they are detained.
how long can they be detained for?
Potentially as long as it takes to determine the refugee claim.
Speaking of detention, you're saying about moving people out of police cells, so why exactly can't you do that now? What about Mungaree?
Well, Mungaree is not secure to a sufficient standard to qualify, really. We by no means put everybody in a police cell. I mean, a number of people do go to Mungaree, but there are some cases where you need to have a level of security that Mungaree doesn't provide. At the moment, police cells are the only option. And what I'm signalling is that in the future we hope to have some separate facilities that are appropriate to an airport-type base. But that's work we've still got to do.
Could you just explain what it is that you can't do at Mungaree to make it secure? What impossible thing?
What can't we do at Mungaree? I don't think it would be appropriate in the extreme to have electric fences and barking dogs running around refugee migrants who are trying to settle into New Zealand with their children.
So they prefer the Auckland Central and
Mungaree?
Kevin, good try.
So if I just go to something over here, you mentioned with going back again to Guy's example of this chap that turns up at the airport, he would be put in detention while the refugee claim is assessed, and that detention could be as long as it takes, but my understanding here is that there'll be a 6 month
that
maximum.
The legal standard of proof, if it's not too strong, where the process that the department would have to go through to extend the detention has been codified. Now, there are different processes, and Graham may elaborate, for someone who is, for example, going through detention following a deportation process. That's one system. And there are different provisions if somebody is being detained under a security risk provision. Right, Graham,
and
you want to explain?
The primary difference is between someone who's been detained while we're attempting to deport them, and if they're not cooperating with us, that may take some time, as against someone who's been detained while their legal rights are being pursued by them, like a refugee claim, so that the 6 month provision doesn't come into effect in that second circumstance.
Right, so if you detain somebody who failed their appeal and for argument's sake their lawyer rolled up and said, well, this guy wants a judicial review of this, then that 6 month would apply to him, someone who exhausted everything and they've done a big runner and they were security.
The 6 months would apply to the latter case, i.e. someone whose all their rights have been exhausted and they're trying to move them on.
Just on the classified information stuff, it says that classified information can only be used in visa protection deportation decisions where national or international security applies. Well, isn't there a bit of a chicken and egg thing here? Because sometimes you might not know whether or not there was an international or national security issue until you've seen some classified information on them. How does that process start?
Firstly, national or international security is not the only grounds. It can also be criminal conduct or significant international reputation issues. So there can be different sources of information for that. Look, the reality is that in most cases, the information involved is non-classified. And sometimes, and again, in the majority of cases, I understand that even if there is classified information, there's plenty of corroborating unclassified information upon which decisions are made. Advice I've had is that there would be probably less than the number of cases you could count on one hand in a year where you would have significant classified information but insufficient unclassified. The point is that New Zealanders legitimately expect their borders to be secure from high security risk individuals, and there have been cases in the past where I'm advised if we had had those powers they could have usefully been used to protect the country. So there are safeguards built in here. It's not the first thing you do. We've tried to balance very fully the human rights and justice aspects of this. But the bottom line is, hey, it's a dangerous world out there and New Zealanders deserve to be protected.
Graham, so the bottom line is somebody might end up fighting a deportation order not knowing all the case that the authorities have against them.
No, my understanding is if there is classified information on somebody, then if that's the basis of a decision, then the essence of that, a summary of that, has to be provided to that person's advocate under the new process, and that person themselves under the new process set out in these proposals. So that's expanded protections, but from the discussion document in April. Okay, we are going to disclose as much as we possibly can to the person and their representatives about the nature of the information.
Will that include people who are on security risk certificates, because that was one of the issues in the Zowie case, wasn't it?
I'm not going to make any comments whatsoever about the Zowie case in respect of the generality. Graeme?
Well, there's no proposals here about security risk certificates.
Because that's subject to the 4A review, which hasn't yet been done, but which we're potentially bringing forward.
With the Minister's
power... But good question.
The Minister's power to grant exemption, you were considering making that a last resort, like people have to exhaust all other avenues. That doesn't appear to have been drawn through. Why?
Look, the practice is that the Minister's right... You're talking about a discretionary decision... After a failed appeal, for example,
yes,
case comes to the minister's office. Yep, yep, yep. Look, I think it's essentially to remove the possibility that you could have a valid case and you just don't. Have, okay, I can give you a case. I won't name it. Somebody had a bereavement of their partner while they were in the middle of one of these processes, and there was an overwhelming humanitarian grounds to give them a break. They hadn't yet been through an appeal. That's the kind of case where it makes sense, because you can't write a law for every possible circumstance. Same time, it's balanced with the fact that ministers will have the ability to delegate some discretionary decision-making to some senior officials. The reason for that is to avoid clogging up the ministerial desk with routine appeals on a very high number of cases, and that's unfortunately starting to happen. So we want to reserve the ministerial intervention for the really deserving complex cases or the really urgent matters that are outside policy.
How many cases do you anticipate the minister, coming to the minister's desk?
Less than there are now. How many cases do we currently get going to the Estates Administration? About 4,000 a year, and that's an enormous workload, so I anticipate that would shrink significantly, but of course there will still be many, many cases going to ministers.
What about MPs as a family on behalf of constituents? Would that still go to a minister, or would that be delegated?
Well, potentially it could go to either. MPs may feel that they want to go to ministers. It's still a legitimate and proper role for an MP to make representations on behalf of their constituents. Nothing in this Act changes that. Nor does it change the obligations on the MPs to provide full information to the minister on which to base their decision. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. It's a lot to digest. Good luck. Thank you very much.